Meanwhile, back at the Hall of Justice, our mild-mannered podcasters were bombarded by gamma rays, bitten by radioactive bugs, mutated by toxic waste, irradiated with cosmic rays, born into a world that doesn't understand them.
Hello, everybody. It is August 21st, 2019, otherwise known as New Comic Book Day, and welcome to the Talking Comics Podcast. You're listening to episode number 404. I am your host, Steve Say, and joining me this week are Mr. Bob Reier.
Well, for certain people in the audience, go Seagulls!
And Ms. Sarah Miles.
Hi!
Fun fact for this week's podcast, folks. We're actually recording this episode on Sunday, the 18th, and that's because Sarah has generously booked us a very special guest for this week's show. Now, I know what you're thinking, like, what? Another guest? But you've already had David Pepos and Sean Lewis and Kieran Gillen on this month alone. Who could it be? Well, you probably saw his name in the title. I'm just now realizing. I mean, ladies and gentlemen, we have Invisible Kingdom and Odyssey and Black Bolt artist Christian Ward will be with us. He'll be in the proverbial building later on in this show to talk with us mainly about his upcoming title from Dark Horse, Tommy Gunn Wizards. But you know how we do. We also talk about a little bit of Odyssey, a little bit of Invisible Kingdom, and a couple of random questions to get inside of Christian's brain. It was an awesome interview, and we really, really hope that you all enjoy it. We've also got lightning rounds and open discussion for you. I mentioned last week that we were going to hit questions, but since Joey isn't here, we are going to wait until next week. Yay! Woo! Don't be mad at us. It's fine.
Well, Joey said he had big answers for that one question, so how could we avoid that? You have to let him do it.
Yeah. The biggest answers in the world. So it's all up to him now.
Yeah, well, blame him if this doesn't work.
So before we jump into our lightning rounds and open discussions and stuff, I just want to put the word out there that if anyone is planning on attending Fan Expo Canada next Thursday through Sunday, when you're listening to this, it is this coming weekend, so that's this Thursday through Sunday. Bronwyn and I will be in attendance. Bronwyn will be there on Friday and Saturday, whereas I will be there only on Saturday. We'll be walking around, probably mainly around Artist Alley and where all the comic book creators are. But if you plan on going to the show and you want to say hello, feel free to drop us a message. Bronwyn is at ShinyBabyB on Twitter, whereas I am at Dead_Anchorus. Just send us a message or whatever and be like, hey, I'm going on the show. Yeah, so there you go. There's the business end of things, and I think it might be time for some lightning rounds. It's different every week.
Yes.
Bob, why don't you kick things off for us this time?
Okay, say when.
All right, you have 5 minutes on the clock, and go.
Chip Zdarsky, Carlos Manyo, and Butch Geist continue to hit it out of the park with Invaders number 8. A wonderfully intricate plot is woven around deep Marvel history, but one that is subtly different than we know it to be. With a pair of reunions, plus two characters from Neighbors Past in very interesting roles, this was just another stellar issue of one of my absolute favorite new series. Captain Marvel number 9 by Kelly Thompson, Carmen Carnero, and Tamara Bonvillon is part 2 of the Falling Star arc. Despite Carol's powers failing her, she's still in there pitching to get to the bottom of that and some other possibly related mysteries. Ms. Thompson shines a spotlight on Carol's relationships with Rhodey, Jessica Drew, and Tony Stark. And so even within a darker tale, there's a sense of positivity that permeates the proceedings. A number of surprises, too, including, and wait for it, the Carol Cave. Wonder Woman 76 by G. Willow Wilson and guest artist Lee Garbett is another book centering on reunions. One, of course, being the long-awaited return of Hippolyta and the Amazons into Diana's life. Plus, we also catch up with Steve Trevor in a lovely vignette. Now, here we go. All this stuff is prelude, because the third reunion is something that truly demonstrates the strength of Wonder Woman and G. Willow Wilson's writing. It's hard because I'll try to be spoiler-free here. Diana creates a special moment for someone who has basically professed nothing but hatred of her at every opportunity. But it creates a beautiful moment, one that, as he does throughout, Lee Garbett just delivers it as a grand slam. The emotional beats with just every nuance depicted beautifully. Kudos also to the incredible Romulo Fajardo Jr., who subtly adjusts his color palette to Mr. Garbett's line work, but still keeps it in character with all that he's done previously. Fantastic Four number 13 by Dan Slott, Sean Isaacs, I guess I'm pronouncing it that way, and Marco Menes, Joe Caramagna, is the knockout finale of one of the greatest Hulk versus Thing battles of all time. Made so, to my mind, by, well, I won't spoil, but suffice it to say, it's a very emotional moment that had me reaching twice for the Kleenex. Now, there's certainly a lot of fantastic fisticuffs, too, but it's the multiple layers supporting them that made this very, very special. Speaking of special and spoilers, Unbeatable Squirrel Girl number 47 by Ryan North, Derek Charm, Rico Renzi, and Travis Lanham opens the final arc of this stellar series with a story so filled with surprises and shocking twists that there's little I can highlight without ruining a fabulous reading experience. What I can say is that Doreen will be tested more than ever before as an old foe seeks to turn everything that makes Doreen unbeatable turned against her. Lots of tissues here too, folks, so be prepared.
Oh, boy.
That's it for me.
I didn't get to read any of those books this week. It's been so crazy. But I see, Sarah, you read Captain Marvel, correct?
I did. I did. Absolutely loved it. I'm really, really enjoying the run on Captain Marvel at the moment. It's every single issue. It goes somewhere I don't expect it to go. Yeah, absolutely loving it. Art is gorgeous as well. So beautiful. So if anybody isn't reading Captain Marvel, I know that they've had some issues with the last couple of episodes. There were some issues with the last couple of issues because people are like buying them up because new characters are being introduced and whatnot. Yes. There is a second printing of issue 8 coming out this week. So if you aren't caught up on it, I would highly recommend that you do, because this is, I know we say it quite often about books, but this is a special book. Very special things are happening here. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely awesome and I'm loving it.
Yeah.
This episode is going to cost everybody so much money.
I think so.
Like we've already done the Christian interview, right? So we talk about things that if you're not reading those things, Christian is going to work his magic on you and you're going to be like, oh, I don't have to eat this week.
Oh, the number of times I've said that. This is just payback for all the times that I was a listener and I listened to you guys talk about
books. Happens.
Like,
it happens every couple of weeks. I get somebody that messages me and is just like, you guys cost me so much money.
And folks, we do it to each other too, so don't feel bad.
Yeah, that is also true.
Yeah, you do not want to look at our comic bills. They're pretty good. Although, I have to say, I do follow a couple of people on Twitter that I know listen to this show that, man, they go hard in the paint. Like, I see, I'm not going to name names, but, like, there's somebody that just, they put their stack on the table and they just pull book after book away from one another until they get to the bottom. And it, like, it eats up the entire allotted time that you're allowed to make a video on, like, social media platforms. It's wild. I can't believe it. Like, that used to be me back when I was still picking up physical books at Tor with Rob and everything.
Oh, boy.
He was so generous, and I would walk out of there with some, like, upward of, like, 40-something books within a week.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, like, now that I'm so removed from that practice, to see other people still doing that and doing it week after week after week, I can kind of see where, like, it's a little mind-blowing.
My local comic shop is It is small. It is very small. And I went in there the other day. I was chatting to one of the guys that worked there, and he went to serve a customer. So I kind of wandered over to the trade section and just started randomly picking books up. And then I carried this pile over to him, and he was like, "Really?" I went, "Yeah, can you just, I'll come in at the weekend and get them." And they were trades. They weren't even single issues. One of them, Steve, is your fault. I'm going to put that one out there now. Because I found a random copy of Oh Joy Sex Toy, which I remember you talking about reading. Yeah. Well, the stupid thing was they have so many books that they can't fit them all on the shelves. So there was kind of a pile of the books on the floor, slightly buried, kind of close to the children's section. So I'm like, I'm going to buy this to stop anything awkward happening. That's my excuse, and I'm sticking to it.
Oh Joy Sex Toy is very much a bloggy kind of thing. There's not too much of a through line in turn. It's very educational, though. I will say that you learn a lot.
I had a little flick through. It looked very interesting.
Yes, you learn a lot about the body while reading Oh Joy. And there's another volume of it too. It's actually quite extensive.
Really? That's just cost me another 30 quid then. Thanks.
Money. Who needs it, right? All right.
Literally just ate yogurt for my dinner.
That's good, though, with fruit.
It's protein.
There you go. All right, Sarah, why don't we stick with you, and I will put 5 minutes on the clock, and you can make with it what you will. Go.
Okay, I'm going to start off with Once and Future from Kieran Gillen, Dan Mora, Tamara Bonvillain, and Ed Dukeshire. For those of you who have already tuned into last week's special extra episode in which Joey and I got to talk to Kieran Gillen, it will come as no surprise that one of my favourite books of this week was Once and Future. Telling the story of Duncan Maguire, a clumsy, unlucky in love rugby-playing academic, and his grandmother, Bridget, a plucky, smart, vampire-hunting, all-round badass old lady. This is not your average retelling of the Arthurian mythos. In your run-of-the-mill story, Arthur is the king destined to return in Britain's darkest hour to save us all. Sidebar, if you want an epic comic giving you this version of the legend, check out Camelot 3000 from Mike W. Barr, Brian Bolland and team. That was released by DC many, many moons ago. There is a gorgeous deluxe edition. But that's not the book I'm talking about now. In Once and Future, Gillen gives us murderous ultra-nationalists in all their shaven-headed, black-shirted, not glory, even though that's the obvious word to use, who are robbing archaeological digs to try and resurrect the fabled Once and Future king. I don't want to give away all of the plot points, but I will say this is a truly beautiful book, especially the colour work aiding the story. Pay close attention to what Tamara Bonvillain does with the sky, folks. Mm-hmm. As the weirdness starts. Speaking of weirdness, I finally got my teeth into a young animal title, which Steve has been recommending forever. In this case, I looked at Collapser from Mikey Way, Sean Simon, Ilias... What have I written down there? Ilias Kirizis? Chris Peter and Simon Boland. I'm really sorry to all of those creators.
I'll go to one of my issues and I'll check you on that.
I do not have the issue sitting in front of me, and I wrote too fast.
Here we go.
Help me out here, Steve.
Sean Simon, Ilias Kirizes.
That's the one. That is not what I've written down.
K-Y-R-I-A-Z-I-S. See, it's not just us, people. Sometimes these names are hard.
Anywho, moving swiftly on. Collapser is about a wannabe DJ who has a bit of a bad night, I'm going to be honest, and wakes up the next morning to open the surprise parcel that he received, and then has a black hole embedded in his chest. It makes a lot more sense if you actually read the book. I don't know if this is one of those young animal titles where it's a book that used to exist many, many moons ago and they've now brought it back. I kind of imagine that it is because there's like a whole thing going on with the lead character's mum that he doesn't know, and she kind of gets mentioned in the story, and perhaps she might be the reason he has a black hole embedded in his chest. It's really weird. Like, really weird. And also, There's also this whole other thing with an old folks home, and I'm not quite sure how I've managed to end up with two books about people in old folks homes in my lightning round in 1 week, when I don't think I've ever mentioned that before. But anyway, issues one and two are both fully trippy. Absolutely loved them. Issue two goes to some incredibly strange places, and for a while I thought I was reading one story about mental health and how people deal with mental health issues, and whether the best thing to do is to accept that they say what they that they're seeing what they say they're seeing. But then I actually got a completely different story. I can't explain this without giving anything away, but at one point there are floating space squirrels. I can't describe them any other way. You need to go and read this book. It's ridiculous. It's trippy. The art is beautiful. There's some absolutely gorgeous colour work in here. Lots of purples and reds and psychiatric issues. Really, really good book. Talking of issues, I have managed to trap a nerve in my shoulder, so I am having to rest today. And anybody who knows me knows I am very, very terrible at doing nothing. So I thought I would take the opportunity to check out The Boys, the TV show on Amazon Prime that lots of people have been talking about. I'm three episodes in now. It took me most of the first episode to get my brain around whatever it is that is happening with Carl Urban's accent. I don't even know. But I'm actually really enjoying it. Lots of people kind of said, oh, we'll stick with it past episode one because it gets a bit better. And like I said, three episodes in, really enjoying it. We'll probably check out the rest of it later on today because I physically can't do anything else. But,
I laugh at
yeah.
your pain.
Thanks, please do.
Join me.
But yeah, so if you haven't checked it out yet, it is super violent. It comes up with a lot of warnings before each episode, some of which are more justified than others. But then having read some of the source material of the book, I was kind of expecting hyper-violence. Mm-hmm. So I will check back in next week when I finish watching all of it. But yeah, can I just please point out, people in Britain do not talk like that. That's it.
Like Lightning Round Billy Butcher?
Like Dick Van Dyke by way of Jason Statham. There is a word that I am not supposed to use because it's an incredibly rude word and people get very insulted when I use the word. It's got four letters. It starts with C. The way that he pronounces that, I have no idea who told him people in Britain talk like that. But it's like Dick Van Dyke trying to be an East End gangster, but really badly. Like, it's hilarious. It's been hurting me where I've been laughing so much at his accent. I don't think I'm supposed to have laughed so much. But the show itself is also very funny. Yeah. Get past the accent. Watch the rest of the show.
I can vouch for... I feel like that show got better with every episode. And it's a nice 8 episodes. It's a really nice introduction. The show's been doing extremely well for them. They're already filming the second season. I mean, I read most of The Boys. I believe I read the first 4 trades, I would say, of that. Mm. And it feels to me like it's wildly different from the comic book series. Like, I remember characters and such, but I don't remember the specific events going the way that they do, particularly in the latter episodes. So if anybody wants to tweet us or correct me on that, I would love for you to jog my memory. But yeah, it's crazy. Like, they even go into some stuff with the superheroes where you almost forget how miserable and dastardly they are, and how corrupted they've become by the corporations that you know, they fly under their brand and whatnot. And yeah, it's weird. It turns superheroes on their head in a really interesting way that I don't think a lot of people that are strictly like of comic book cinema have seen before. And so it's interesting to be taking down these heroes that everyone loves so many pegs and making them these corrupt individuals. I really, really enjoyed the hell out of that show. It's one of the better things, comic book wise, like comic to film, that I've seen this year.
Yeah, it's I mean, it is a trip, and it has a lot of very scathing social commentary in it about what we accept, about what we're told, you know, and how much faceless corporations do control what we think, as opposed to what's actually happening in reality. I'm very much enjoying it. I'm quite intrigued to see where they're going with it. But hey, you know, British actors exist, New Zealand characters exist, just saying, guys.
It's interesting that if you look at the credits, I alluded to this last week, but didn't really get into it very much. After the first episode, if you look at the credits for writers and directors on that show, it becomes increasingly female run. So written by female writers and directed and so on. And there's a lot of sensitivities, particularly from Starlight's character in the later episodes, that I felt were very, very well written. And her character is just really, really expertly portrayed throughout that first season. And I'm really excited to see them kind of continue that character throughout the second season and see how, like, how much more positive messaging they can use that character for. It's very, very well done. And yeah, The Boys is the surprise smash of the summer as far as comic book television goes. Because all those Netflix shows, those are done. So we got to wait for, I guess, like the next season of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. There's probably a couple of other. Oh, that Watchmen thing's coming out. Damon Lindelof's Watchmen. Will probably be out.
Releasing another edition of that book this week. The international edition with a lenticular cover.
Oh, yeah.
When I saw that, I was like, oh, man.
Gotta
really?
Let that Rorschach shine.
Sparkly Rorschach for the win.
I haven't read Watchmen in so long. I remember enjoying it when I read it, but like that was, God, it has to be at least 5 or 6 years ago that I read that book.
Yep.
So yeah, Collapser. Collapser, I only read the first issue. I do have the second. I just didn't make it to many books this week. And I loved that first issue. Very, very trippy, as you were saying. And
wait for number two.
I don't know that it's an old property from like Vertigo or DC, but it has that young animal flavor to it. You know, like once you start, like it's weird. Like that's kind of what Young Animal does so well, and it fits right in there alongside like the new Doom Patrol. And there's two other books that are coming out, I believe, before the end of the summer. And, yeah, Young Animal, they're back. Very excited. Alrighty. Bob, do you have any comments or questions for Sarah about her books?
Have you read any of the other Young Animal stuff, or is this your first experience?
This was my first foray into Young Animal. I'm probably now going to have to go in and read a whole bunch of the other stuff. I think with something like Doom Patrol, I was always kind of put off because I hadn't read any of the older Doom Patrol stuff. Literally my entire knowledge of Doom Patrol comes from that one episode of Teen Titans or Titans, the TV show adaptation. Okay. Mm-hmm. I've completely forgotten what it's called. I think it's just called Titans. That was an awesome show, by the way. Yeah, so like that's my entire knowledge of Doom Patrol. I haven't seen the TV show, but Steve said so many good things about Shade the Changing Girl.
I think you'd love that.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to.
I think you would really dig Shade. My recommendation for you from the Young Animal Library would be Eternity Girl from Mags Visaggio and Sonny Liu.
Oh,
ooh.
Oh yeah,
that's a creative team right there.
Eisner nominated. That series was fantastic. The only reason I didn't push for it during the end of the year stuff is I just didn't know if anybody was going to be on board for it. But I think, Sarah, you should, if you dive into anything, go look for Eternity Girl.
Okay.
It's fantastic.
I'll put it on the list.
Fantastic. All right. I have got a lightning round in my pocket. Here we go. Put 5 minutes on the clock for me and Bob. All right, so here we are. The White Trees. I actually got up off my butt and went to the comic book store for this. It ended up costing me $55.
For one
because
buck?
Because I saw the new Ms. Marvel hardcover volume 5 sitting on the shelf, all new and alone, and I was like, aw, I have friends back at my house that you should hang out with. So I picked up both of these. The White Trees, written by Chip Zdarsky, illustrations by Chris Anka, colors by Matt Wilson, and letters by Aditya Bidikar. Okay, names, here we go. Krylos the Bold, Sir Skotir of Blacksand, and Sir Dovland the Swift have been summoned to the quarters summoned to their quarters to discuss a matter most dire. It's supposed to be their Majesty's quarters to discuss a matter most dire. It would seem that the Trilonians are beating their drums of war, and as part of their opening gambit, they've stolen the children of our aforementioned characters. Rather than wait for their Majesty's men to sort the matter, the three who used to be the stuff of legend form a trifecta and go out in search of their missing children. Understand something about White Trees, my friends. There is a lot of heat coming off of this book. All three men in the Triforce are beautiful. I see Krylos as the stoic daddy, Skotir as the gentle touch, and Dovlin as the gruff bear of the group. You know what else there's a lot of in this book? Fantasy peen. And lots of fantasy peen. Enchanted breasts and luminescent pubic hair. And you know what? I am totally here for it. As long as I've been reading comics, I don't think that I can say that I've ever encountered what can only be described as sex sirens before. Yet, here we are. Leave it to Chip Zdarsky to take my hand and introduce me to these people. Anyway, I've probably said too much already, but it's a little difficult to describe a book when a series is only 2 issues long. Granted, like, it's double-sized, but I don't get it. The world that Zdarsky, Anka, and Wilson have created here feels like it could take place and be explored for years to come by this team. I'm sorry, I'm stumbling all over my notes. It's Sunday, I'm tired. I didn't have enough coffee. I really do hope that there's more to come and that they're simply testing the waters. That's not to say that they don't take full advantage of this first issue. The Warrior's Quest is urgent and emotional, and the world feels like it spans continents of wonder with fantastic beasts hiding behind every mountainside. There's also a fine lesson to be taught about the taboos of forbidden love, and how even if you try to keep lovers apart, the heart wants what it wants and will always find a way. Funnily enough, the other book that I have to talk about is also a little bit of the old taboo. I read issues 1 through 12, the whole run of Mirka Andolfo's Unnatural. I discovered that she's going to be at Fan Expo this coming weekend, and I freaked out because I love her stuff. And realized that I hadn't read, hadn't checked in with Unnatural in a while. So I read that whole thing. Unnatural tells the tale of Leslie, a beautiful, curvy, anthropomorphic pig, who on her 25th birthday must comply with the New Rourke City. Ooh. Get it? Because animals roar. Yeah. New Rourke City's reproductive program. A mandatory match service that pairs males and females of the same species together for the sake of natural procreation. You see, the reproductive program is all about maintaining the status quo and assuring that the future is populated by same species babies born of the purest blood. Is this oppression yarn starting to sound a little familiar? Those who comply with the terms of the reproduction program will be given cushy benefits, while those who choose to love outside the lines are heavily taxed, publicly shamed, in some cases lobotomized, and in other cases, on a second offense, put to death. Here's the thing about Leslie, though. Lately, she's been having erotic dreams about a mysterious and powerful white wolf, who, when they're together, refers to Leslie as his bride. What's up with that? As the dreams intensify, so does an ancient power that makes Leslie an apex predator among her peers. This is bad news because the nefarious organization in charge of the reproductive program know of Leslie's dreams and they kind of have an idea as to what's going on. And so they're trying to harness the power of the white wolf that is growing inside of her so that they can then turn that power toward their reproductive program and essentially create like an alpha bloodline, a master race, if you will, where only the strong survive while the weak are segregated from the rest of society and left to die in their own parts of the world. Hmm. Again, does any of this sound familiar? As you can imagine, the book finds Leslie on the run from the organization while also struggling to keep the beast within her from taking over. A lot of good people die along the way. I was quite devastated by some of the events of this book. While the freedom to choose who you love continues to hang in the balance of everything that's going on. Unnatural is a lot of things. It's Zootopia meets the struggles of the LGBTQ plus community. It's steamy, seductive, it's strange. It's 12 issues of an intricate mystery that deals with the suppression of desires in a society that won't accept that the rules of love have changed and will continue to do so. And it's quite powerful in that regard. And I know that the first issue, they don't really lay into that stuff too much. And so it put a couple of people off to the series. But I promise you that as it goes along, there's a lot of very positive messaging about being able to love who you want to love free of judgment and whatnot. And that, you know, intermingling of peoples is necessary for us to move on as a society. I don't really understand what the problem is here. Anyway, I don't want to get weird on you anything. I'm just very supportive of this kind of stuff. Anyway, I loved Unnatural. I'm really glad that I read it. And if you are a fan of Mirka Andolfo's art, this is just a showcase of everything that she can do and more. And she's a hell of a writer to boot. So there you go. Unnatural.
That sounds so good.
I think, Sarah, I think you would really, really love it. It's quite erotic at times. I'm not going to lie. It's tastefully done. Mm-hmm. Very tastefully done. But, like, I'll be reading and I'll be, like, I'll turn the page and I'll, whoa! And I have to, it like, the way that my iPad is, I have to turn it on its side to flip the page so that I could see the whole spread, if you will. And I'm just, like, the process of having to turn the thing so that I can look at this gorgeous naked character to read all of this stuff where all the words are along her body. And I'm just like, all right, this is the thing that's happening right now. Anyway, lots of mystery, lots of fun, lots of great characters, a world that just feels alive and busy and there's oppression happening on all sides. And I just love Mirka Andolfo's art so, so much. And she does a great, it's probably a furry's a wet dream, this series. So if you're at all into that, you definitely want to be reading Unnatural. It just wrapped up with its 12th issue. There might be more down the road. There was a little bit of a tease at in the liner notes of the last issue that it's been doing really well in the States and that there could be more to the story. It definitely leaves it open-ended for more at the end. And yeah, it was a ride. It was cool. I read all 12 issues yesterday, and I had a lot of fun with it. So there you go.
Awesome.
Yeah. Let's see here. And White Trees, yeah, there was more fantasy peen in White Trees than there was, like, unseemly stuff in Unnatural, so Chip Zdarsky loves that peen. All right. Did anybody else get to read White Trees?
Mm-mm.
All right, well.
No.
Read it alone.
Okay.
Read it alone.
A warning.
Yeah, read it alone. It's good. It's really good. It's really good. It feels, even in just the first issue, it's just rich with character and story and motivation to get on the road and go and find these kids and get them back, and has a lot to do. Like, they should have never been together. How is it that they've run off together? And it taps again into that forbidden love aspect of people from two families that shouldn't be together coming together because the heart wants what it wants. And so I inadvertently read two stories that were all about forbidden love this past week.
I just said and Winkies just because he's mentioned them a lot.
There's one in particular. It's red and it's real big. And and you'll see. You'll see. I turned the page. I was like, ah, that's what everybody was tweeting about. Anyway, great. I think it was Jamie McKelvey that was giving it to Chip Zdarsky online, and they were going back and forth about it. It was pretty funny. Love that. Love that team. Love those. Love that community of creators, and just how they razz one another publicly. It's great. All right. Open discussions. Let me get out the creative team for this book here. So Leah Williams launched her new Gwenpool called Gwenpool Strikes Back number one. And if I could find the creative team, that would be nice.
Leah Williams, David Baldion, who just came off of Domino with Gail Simone. We have Jesus Arbutov and VC's Joe Caramagna.
Thank you, Bob.
No problem.
Thank you very much. I think it might be all the way in the back. I couldn't find it.
Yes, it is.
All right. So Gwenpool has been kind of a strange character ever since she was introduced. It doesn't seem like too many creators know what the limitations of her superhero skill set or lack thereof really is all about. But she's very Deadpool-like in that she's able to kind of manipulate what you have in your hands, what you're reading. She's conscious of the fact that she's in a comic book. She comes from our world, and she knows all about the superheroes. And so here she is in her first solo book, and she basically is like, I keep getting bopped around. I've been on teams. I've, you know, shown up here and there, but I finally have my own book. But without really having defining characteristics of what my powers are, I need to get powers if I'm going to survive. And her mission becomes tracking down her superhero friends to try and have them help her get superpowers. And in this first issue, she basically stages a heist so that Spider-Man will show up in the hope of that he can bite her and she will become the radioactive Gwenpool or whatever. And, you know, he then explains to her that it was a radioactive spider and that spider is dead, so on and so forth. Anyway, that is basically the setup for Gwenpool Strikes Back. And I got to say, this book, and even within the first couple of pages, rivals the amount of stuff you need to read in something like an Unbeatable Squirrel Girl book. I was very intimidated by all that was happening within even just the first three pages of this book. There's lots of interior monologuing, tons of jokes. There's some stuff with Spider-Man in this book that had me laughing out loud like crazy. Don't want to give away too much else. I will say this. I really enjoyed the book. I think I enjoyed the actual dialogue portions. Like I said, once she meets up with Spider-Man, I was having a really, really good time. The book is crazy in its presentation, and how this version, Leah's version of Gwenpool is that she's like, if you took all the Fortnite kids in the world and their online personas and just mushed it into a Marvel character, that's very much how I see Gwenpool, in that, like, even just on one page, she's flossing, she's dabbing, she's doing the heart hands. At one point when she's thinking to herself, kudos for having thought bubbles. I've noticed that they've been making a comeback lately, and that excites me greatly. You even have in her thought bubbles the Pikachu holding the sign with text on it thing that shows up on people's Twitter feeds all the time. So it's very much trying to replicate that world and that form of speech, which I commend it. And I think it's very cool. And I think it's very well executed. However, like, that stuff drives me up a wall most of the time. And so I found the Gwenpool character kind of like irritating me for the first little bit of this book. But like I said, once Spider-Man enters the picture and Gwenpool literally drops her drawers and starts interacting with him, she's riffing, telling jokes. Their chemistry is great. Really, really was having a lot of fun with the book. Gets very, very weird toward, I guess, the third act, if you will. And I really have no idea where this is going to go next. And I'm both terrified and excited to find out, because this was... I got thrown through a loop within the last, like, six pages of this book, and I have no idea what's going on. So, Bob, why don't you jump in and tell me what you thought?
I enjoyed the heck out of this, as it reminded me of one of my all-time favorites. It's the classic John Byrne run on She-Hulk, which was way back in the day. In that series, when he did it, he did 1-8 and then 31-50. Jennifer Walters would not only break the fourth wall, but, I mean, obliterate it. She knew she was in a comic, and she would not only then break that fourth wall, she would then comment on the tropes of comics and air her grievances to John Byrne and the editors and everybody else. And so this had that feel for me. Those scenes of a page that must have 4,000 words on it, it seems like.
Yeah.
Really, really, that tickled my fancy. I mostly know Gwenpool from, I know she had a solo series before, I guess, but it was for West Coast Avengers.
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry. Yeah, she totally did.
So for me, that Watchmen-esque 9-panel page of her standing there explaining all of her goings-on or whatever, that was just informative, hilarious. You add in some Jeff the Landshark bank robbery cosplay. You throw Spidey in. I love this. I absolutely love it. Right up my alley.
Did you catch most of the references, like all the internet speak and stuff? Because
No, I got the Pikachu sign. I get that.
Okay.
But some of the other things, no. But you know, I'll figure it out.
God, I don't even know what some of these dance moves are called. I just know that they're not even dance moves. They're emotes. They're Fortnite emotes. But that's what kids constitute as dancing these days. We're living in crazy, crazy times. I'm getting old. this is not for the faint of heart. You really, it's very manic. Like, you got to keep up with Gwenpool. I find her to be slightly exhausting as a character.
I think that's the idea.
I know. I don't know how much my heart can take within an issue. This issue was a lot, but so is that character. And so for that reason and many more, like, I think it was a successful first issue. I just have no idea where we're going. It just ends. It just cuts off. Like, all of a sudden I turn the page and it was credits. I'm like, whoa.
Well, they want you to go. No, they want you to loop back to page 19, panel 5. Sure. And reread the end of the story again. Panel 3, I'm sorry. Page 15, panel 3. It's like that Silver Surfer issue that you had to read twice, once in each direction.
Oh, the Mobius strip one?
Yep.
Nice. Yeah. So, there you go. Gwenpool Strikes Back number 1. If you can handle it, then definitely go and check it out. I love Leah Williams as a writer and as a relatively new talent to the game. She's been doing some amazing stuff between last year and this one. So, I'm excited to see where it goes. I have enough faith in her. I follow her on Twitter and I absolutely love her posts and her attitude. This feels like a venting ground for some of the stuff that she endures from the online public, because nobody knows how to behave. There's no accountability. There's no, you know, Twitter police coming down on you sometimes, but not enough. Anyway.
Sarah, did you get to read Gwenpool?
Yep.
Uh-oh. Okay, go ahead.
I am old. I do not get youth references. I do not understand youth speak.
Wow, youth references.
Yeah. You know, you said about the Pikachu holding the sign thing?
Yeah.
I didn't know that was supposed to be Pikachu. I thought it was a rabbit. if I want fourth wall breaking comics, I will read Deadpool. This book is not for me. It was not written for me. I love Gwenpool when she's in West Coast Avengers. This book, it was manic and it was wordy and it made my head hurt a bit. And it just made me feel really old. I was like, I don't need to see a character flossing in her pajamas. I can go to the supermarket and see kids flossing in their pajamas. Get off my lawn.
You know what it is? You know what I think it is? I think everybody has those friends that you have people that you can hang out with all the time. And then you have people that are small doses people where you love them. You love hanging out with them. But like, it could be a little while. You could wait. It's fine. You know, like, yeah. I'll see you at the party when I see you. We're busy today. Gwenpool is one of those characters for me where I think if I spent too much time around her, she would just, I don't know what I would do to myself. Probably something really terrible. So I'll be curious to see how long this can take hold of me. But yeah, I don't know. Mixed emotions from me on this one. Bob absolutely loved it. Sarah, it's not for you, which is fair enough. And
no, but as I always say at this point, this book is for someone. It may not be for me, but there are plenty of books out there for me. It just means that I will spend my money on a different book instead of spending it on this book. And that is what it is. But it did genuinely just make me like, I'm old. I don't get it. I'm going to have to text pictures to Bella and ask her what this means because, well, I don't play Fortnite. It's just too frantic. It's too much like hard work. Sorry. I'm in pain and I get really grouchy when I'm in pain.
All right. Well, that brings us to the end of our open discussion. And so when we come back, we're actually going to have Christian Ward hanging out with us. And so, yeah, stay tuned. We are back and we've got Christian Ward in the house. Sarah has the talking stick for this interview, so Sarah, please take it away.
Thank you very much, Steve. First of all, I would like to say thank you very much, Christian, for joining us today. Welcome to Talking Comics.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Anybody who listens to the show on a regular basis will know that I fangirl over your work every single time it's presented to me. But one thing that we do always like to ask our guests, just to get to know them a little bit better, is their comics origin story. So can you kind of tell us how you got to be where you are now in the world of comics?
It's quite a convoluted, roundabout way. It took me a while to do it. I'm feeling like a lot of comic book kind of creators. I started out as a fan when I was, you know, a child. And up to the age of 16, it's all I wanted to do. And my art teacher at the time, well, all my art teachers at the time, did everything they could do to persuade me from it. And it was, I'm from a small town in the UK called Wolverhampton, now a city. And if you want to be a comic book artist, it's not really the place where you would be. You know, the idea of doing that as a profession, even being an artist as a profession, is kind of, it's not really what you do. You go and work in an office or a supermarket or in a factory. That's what you do. So everyone kind of persuaded me against this career. So I ended up being a school teacher for 10 years in London, where I kind of sort of went up through the ranks and eventually became head of department of my secondary school where I taught. And because I was always a fan of comics, I implemented a big part of the curriculum was comic books, because they were really good at kind of stealth learning. You could use it to sort of get like kind of disenfranchised teenagers they think they're learning about comics, which they are, but you're also kind of hiding things like body proportion, composition skills, storytelling. There's a lot of the kind of like natural curriculum that you can kind of hide in it. So I used to do this a lot, and none of my colleagues knew anything about comics. So I would do all the worksheets, and what I would do is all the worksheets would be a comic book page, so it would be presented like a comic book. And I think I remember one day I just had a really kind of bratty year nine kid sort of say to me, if you're so good at this, why aren't you doing it? In a matter of fact way that kids do. And I was just like, well, I will. And like a couple of years later, I just left to do it. So it's all this kid's fault. So I have him to thank or blame, depending on your point of view. But for about 3-4 years, I kind of did both. So my first comic, Olympus, that I did with Image, I was a full-time teacher at the time. Then I went on to do Infinite Vacation, again at Image, with Nick Spencer. And again, that was done while I was a full-time teacher. And then I met Matt on Twitter, Matt Fraction, and we kind of fell in love. Don't tell Cody too. Then we did Odyssey, and obviously Matt being Matt, he was a huge star. And I was able to think, well, you know, if I can't do this full-time with Matt Fraction, I'll never be full-time. So I just took the leap then. And I haven't looked back. And that's it. And I'm constantly evolving as we go forward.
Well, I would like to thank that bratty year nine boy.
Yes.
For the fact that he basically just forced you into being a comic creator full-time.
My whole career is based on revenge for that little...
Yes. You should make sure he gets copies of your stuff, Christian. I'm reminded of a story. There was Harlan Ellison, the science fiction writer, was told by an English professor back in the 50s somewhere that you're never going to have a career at this. So he then sent him a copy of everything he ever had published. He sent him a encased in Lucite block copy of Harlan's own entry into Who's Who. And he continued on the revenge theme for about 40 years.
That's amazing.
Just insert him into like crowd shots.
Yeah, have giant robots and things fall on him and buildings and unicorns stab him through the chest. Just go for it.
That's so creepy.
Yeah,
it's great. Good story for the kids.
So you mentioned working with Matt Fraction there and Odyssey. That was basically my introduction to your work was Odyssey. Obviously that's a book that we got some of, but there is more story to be told there. Will we ever get to see the rest of the journey? Would you return to the series if given the chance?
It's such a tricky thing, Odyssey. I mean, I talk about it on Twitter quite a lot. And me and Matt, you know, we stay in touch, obviously, and we do talk about it from time to time. It's tricky. I would say before I say anything else, we would both love to. I think if we were able to, we would continue Odyssey, like, straight away. It would be, like, for instance, it would be my next... I'd return to it after Invisible Kingdom finished. We both really want to finish telling that story. We both love the book, you know, very personally. It's a very difficult book because, well, one, it didn't make a lot of money, because who knew that a book written in verse with no speech bubbles wouldn't be a massive, you know, mainstream hit? I don't know. It's one of these things. I remember talking to... Kieran Gillen, who I know you had on last week, and we were talking about it, and I sent him the first PDF because we live next to quite close to each other when I lived in London, and he said to me, not everyone's going to love this book, but everyone that does love this book will really love this book, and it'll inspire very intense feelings from the people that get it. And it did. So we have a lot of loyal fans who really love the book, and it's the one question I get asked on Twitter, you know, semi-regularly, you know, is it coming back? Are you coming back? Whenever I tease a new project, people say, please, is it Odyssey? But we don't have a huge number of those fans. It's, you know, and every issue that we released, it was like a dwindling number, like it is with a lot of kind of creator-owned books. That's nothing special. But I think that the difficulty is here, and I'm kind of speaking for Matt, so I'll hope he'll forgive me if I kind of misquote him. And this is just based on conversations we've had. In the same way that when I draw the book, it's not an easy book to draw. Because we're trying to do something different with the structure and the form of it. We've had the gods kind of above the structure of the comics, and the kind of characters like Odysseia are within the structure of the comics, and how those two things interplay. In the same regard, that an issue would take me close to 2 months each time to sort of really work out. How's it going to work? You know, where are all the structural things going to happen? How's the panel structures going to work? It would also take Matt a similar time to write the scripts. I was always really disappointed he didn't put his scripts into the hardback that you've just mentioned, because they're insane. His research and amount of work, physical kind of work that went into each script, was mind-blowing. And he would do all this work that sometimes I wouldn't even see in the final script. It was like his own notes from the pacing and getting the cadence right and the kind of structure of the verse to the kind of the research of the characters and where the story was going. More and more we were going to put in allusions to and references to other stories and tie it all together. You know, this is, you know, a lot of Greek mythology was like the birth of a certain type of story. And then we were going to look at other stories that were inspired by those sort of stories. And so it became, okay, well, we're working X amount of time, both myself and Matt, and we're earning X amount of money, you know. And it was just a thing. Now, Matt's got a young, you know, a family with, you know, two children. I've got a young daughter who's now two, and it was the decision to sort of, and it's funny because I kind of regret this every day, but no, at the time I didn't really have, it was the right, I made the right decision, but I still regret it, if that makes sense. I got offered, the editor at Marvel, he offered me Batbolt, which I did with Saladin. And me and Matt talked today because we were moving into the third arc of Odyssey, which was going to be the big return of Odysseia. You know, we had all these plans. Matt was like getting really excited, and then they offered me this Marvel book, and just on hard cash, I would earn more from one issue of, basically, I would earn pretty much double on one issue of Black Bolt than I would on, you know, an issue and a half of Odyssey. And at the time, like, me and my wife were expecting, so we knew we had to move out of London, where I lived there at the time, and move to where I am now, which is Shrewsbury, which is a town in the sort of middle of England. And we had to buy a house, and we had to kind of like renovate a house, and it was just the hard reality of it. If I carry on with this creator-owned book, which I love and Matt love, it's going to be tight. It's going to be really tough financially, because of the pay, and two, because the amount of time it would take me and Matt to do an issue. And so I ended up going off to do Black Bolt, which I don't regret. You know, it won us an Eisner, which was amazing. It kind of opened up other doors for me as a kind of as a creator. But every day, I just, especially like with, like, you know, Jamie and Kieran just finishing Wicked and Divine, there's a big part of me that's, oh God, it would have been amazing. Knowing what we were going to do with it, it would have been amazing to finish it. I would love to do it. Matt would love to do it. But I think the thing with Matt is if he can write another script, in the time it would take him to write a script of Odyssey, if he could basically write three other, like, you know, scripts, then that's the financial, you know, when you've got a family, you kind of have to think, well, that I've got to pay the mortgage, I've got to pay the bills. And that's the kind of the hard truth of it. I like to think that if we get to a point in our careers where, you know, we've made a ton of money and we don't have to worry so much about paying the bills, That might be when we do it. It might be the thing that we do for us when we're, you know, semi-retired or something, that we just come back and just like do a crazy, crazy comic just for us. I mean, I miss working with Matt dearly. I mean, I've had so many amazing, fantastic collaborators who have all been wonderful to work with, and, you know, and I've become friends with many of them. But there's something about working with Matt that I really, really, really miss. I hope we will do it again. But it's the reality of it, it is kind of against us. But who knows? Who knows what will happen?
Never say never.
We're willing. It's just whether financially able to sort of do it.
Mm. So we need to kidnap you and Matt and put you in a building somewhere and just throw money at you.
Well, I'd do it then. Yeah.
Brilliant.
Sorted.
I'll have a word with some people.
Yeah.
So obviously your introduction to comics was through your art. You've got a book coming out next week, which is called Tommy Gun Wizards, which you've actually written.
Gosh.
So when did you decide you wanted to turn your hand to writing comics rather than creating the art for them?
Well, it really, before I even drew my first one, it's always been the plan. When I was at school, I used to write and draw, like, not teaching, like, when I was actually a pupil at school, I used to write and draw a comic. When I was in primary school, that I would photocopy and then, you know, sell on the playground. So I think a lot of comic book artists, even though they're primarily artists, I think, you know, you're a storyteller first, because you have to, you think of your own stories first to draw them before you know another writer that can write the script for you. So you're already thinking of the stories you want to tell. And the thing with Tommy Gun that's interesting is it's what I was going to do after Infinite Vacation. So I'd done the book with Nick, which I'd co-plotted with him. And so the plan was, right, now I'm going to do this book that I've come up with an idea, and I'm going to draw it and write it. Then I met Matt, and I said, well, that's stupid. I'm not going to write my own book when I can work with Matt Fraction. So that's why that didn't happen then. And it's just sat in my back pocket for the last, well, literally for the last 5-6 years.
Mm.
And it was always the thing that I was going to write and draw. And then I just had a kind of notion that, oh God, I really don't want to draw this book, because I'm going to have to do all this research about how people dressed in the 30s and make the buildings look real. And I've spent the last 10 years drawing cosmic sci-fi stuff where I don't have to worry about authenticity. So it's just, oh God, this is going to be terrible. I'm not going to enjoy this at all. So then I tricked Sammy, who's my artist, Sammy Cavella. I tricked him into doing it like a fool. He said yes.
Christian, super quick.
Yeah.
Did you say earlier in your comment that you used to sell comic books on the playground?
Yeah, I started early.
Yo, I totally got this vision in my head of, like, young Christian having, like, the latest comic and friends coming up to you and be like, yo, man, you got the new issue? Like, yeah,
I wish I was that popular. Let me tell you what this comic was about, and then you might be able to sort of reassess that little imagining that you've got there. The comic was called Captain Lou. Okay, for American listeners, a loo is what we call the toilet.
Yes.
And basically, it was autobiographical. So Captain Lou was myself, and I was a weedy little kid who got bullied. And what I would do is I'd go into the toilet, say my magic word, and I would come out as Captain Lou, big muscly superhero, and then just basically beat the shit out of everyone. And all the bad guys,
yes.
All the bad guys in the comic were based on all the people that would bully me or, like, kind of, you know, take the piss out of me and all this stuff. And so they were all my classmates. So the only people I could sell the comic to were the people that I was taking the mickey out of in the comic. I didn't sell many.
No, I can imagine.
Yeah, I may not have even sold one, but the comic still exists. So that's, you know, I can prove
You still
it.
Have it?
Yeah, I do.
Oh, it needs to be a backup feature somewhere.
Well, I'm not even joking. I have thought very kind of, I might bring it back at some point. Like, no.
I would 100% buy that.
Yeah, I think it could work.
I think that sounds like a young adult graphic novel kind of thing, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
You could have the next Grizzly Shark.
Yeah, exactly.
Captain Lou. I love it.
Could you humor me for a moment and tell me what the magic words are that you said when you went into the toilet?
I was a young man. Well, no, do you know, I do know what they are, but I don't know if I do want to. I used to go, has anyone seen the film Cannonball Run?
Yes.
With Dom DeLuise and Burt Reynolds. Okay, so in Cannonball Run, Dom DeLuise plays this guy who turns into, is it Captain Mayhem or something like that?
Yes.
I can't remember what his name is.
Captain Chaos.
Captain Chaos,
yes.
That's it.
Yeah.
And he goes, dun, 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 and so that was it. So I basically plagiarized Cannonball Run, which was my favourite film as a 9-year-old. Yeah, that's what I used to. In fact, really embarrassingly, when I went on to secondary school, I used to do really well in the sports day, and, you know, running around the track, sprinting. But I could only do it if I shouted dun dun dun. The win always worked. So I'd be running, and at the back of the, and I wouldn't be winning, and I would just go dun dun dun, and I'd always win the race. So it became something that kids, when they heard it,
they knew.
They knew I was coming for them. Yeah, it took a while for me to have a girlfriend.
That all sounds amazing. I would read that in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. I'm just dying over here now. That's amazing. Just got this mental picture of all the other kids hearing the dun-dun-dun and being like, oh, no, he's coming.
Yeah, I was bullied in secondary school as well. I don't know why.
The call reminds me a little bit of Captain Underpants when he goes, tra-la-la. Sarah, do you need a minute? Do you want me to pick up the interview?
No, I'm fine. Okay. I'm just gonna rein it back for a moment.
Take a deep breath.
So, going back to Tommy Gun Wizards, away from Captain Lou, even though I really don't want to leave him. So you said you've had Tommy Gun Wizards in your pocket for the last 5 or so years. The conceit behind the story is that it's Prohibition era Chicago, but it's magic that is banned, not alcohol. What gave you the idea for that? Where did that come from?
Basically, it came about because I was going to draw it. Even though I draw a lot of kind of cosmic stuff and sci-fi stuff, I was always into, like, what I really wanted to draw was, like, kind of dark magic and dark fantasy. Like, my go-to would always be Doctor Strange. He's like my Batman. He's the one that I'd always want to draw.
So we want to see that. We want to see that.
Yes, please.
keep telling Marvel. It was really because I wanted to do something with magic. So I was thinking, so I want to come up with a story that involves magic that I can kind of just go wild with, go crazy. And I was a huge fan of, I love the kind of like Chicago 1930s aesthetic and that whole, you know, one of my favorite films when I was a teenager was Brian De Palma's The Untouchables, which I saw basically in really close, like one almost one after the other. So it was like, so Batman, Tim Burton's 1989 Batman, which kind of has like that faux 1930s kind of gangster vibe to it. And then from that, I saw the Dick Tracy movie with Warren Beatty and Al Pacino, which took that and then kind of went kind of crazy with it. And then saw Brian De Palma's Untouchables, and it was weird in my head. It was kind of, they were all the same sort of thing, even though on the one end you've got a superhero story and then on the other end you've got this story of real people, you know, police officers that were kind of dealing with a real kind of criminal intent in the 1930s. They felt very interchangeable. You've got these larger life kind of good guys and larger than life kind of gangsters who would often have a kind of, you know, almost like comic book names. And so it was always a kind of world that really fascinated me. And I think when I was thinking of magic, it was just like, well, what do I love? Well, I love this, the 1930s stuff, and I love magic. And the minute that thought occurred to me, it was like instantaneous. It was just like, boom, the whole thing just like slotted into place, like immediately. I went to bed with the idea, and it occurred to me. And by the time I woke up in the morning, 75% of the story was there. It was just, it all laid it out. And it just, it really fit with what I wanted to do, like looking at kind of the history of the Prohibition and what brought the Prohibition about and what it did to society and how society reacted to it. It was really easy to kind of take the alcohol out and put this, how we use magic in its place and use those in a very similar way. So even though it is magic, the idea is in the book, it's everyday life for them. It's not like seen as this kind of like wonderful fantasy world. It's just life. So it was an excuse, plain and simple, to just have an excuse to go wild and crazy and really visual and really exciting. And so really that's kind of where it all came from. And then I denied myself any of the pleasure of drawing it. Like,
So when you chose to set the book in Prohibition era America, did you always want to include people like Elliot Ness and Al Capone? Was that always part of that plan that came to you? Or was that more sort of something that happened during the development of it?
Yes and no. So the original idea was I was going to use kind of characters that would be representative of those people. And it just, the more I thought about that and I started to kind of write it down, I was just like, it's pointless because you know who I'm talking about. so it came from, I mean, I think half the kind of joy of the book is that it is those people. And that way, you know, everyone is going to come with at least some notion of their history or what their story could be. And that allows us then to kind of subvert that and do interesting things with it, which you wouldn't be able to do if they were wholly created characters.
Yeah. So talking, that does make sense. Yeah. And I can see the logic behind it. Talking about characters, there are clearly some very flawed characters in Tommy Gun Wizards. I don't want to give too much away because I'm aware of the fact that this podcast comes out the week before the book does. But there's lots of people who have obviously got secrets and things that they're hiding.
I'm clapping my hands in excitement.
how do you go about deciding when to drop a story beat or reveal a secret? And has your experience of reading script as an artist actually changed how you would do that?
No, it hasn't. I mean, I can answer later on or now. Things that I've learned from working with other writers for sure. But I don't know whether this is one thing in particular. I mean, it's weird because this story's kind of existed in my head for 5 years and it's just gone round and round and round. And so I would say it's come more from being a lover of really good TV or being a lover of really good film and knowing story and knowing kind of. I mean, like, I listened to your interview with Kieran last week, and obviously Kieran really knows the craft of kind of creating a comic, and I don't know, I'm not that academic when I'm thinking about writing. It's more instinctive, and more, I could just kind of get a sense of when a thing should be revealed or. You know, it's all about hooks, isn't it? It's all about kind of, you know, teasing and just, you know, you want, you know, I want the readers to come back next week. So, you know, you end with a, what?
You do end with a moment.
Wait until you get to the end of next issue. Yeah, the end of next issue is something. I really kind of storytelling's a bit like magic tricks. Like, it's all about misdirection and kind of like feeding the audience things, and then you want the reveal, and you're like, I didn't see that coming because I was looking over there. And but it's also about, you know, it's really important that anything that you do that is shocking or is a reveal or is a twist, it has to be led by the characters' motivations. And so everything's based on who are these characters, what do they want, why do they want it, and what does that desire conflict with? And that's what the whole book's about. It's not really about the magic. It's not really about, you know, being in Chicago. It's about, you know, you've got these 5-6 characters and they all want something, and those wants conflict with other characters' wants, and that's where the tension arises, and that's where the narrative happens. So it's really just like, well, I know where this is going, and I, you know, it's like dramatic irony, and it's like, how do I, and it's just about teasing it out from a structural point of view, so that each issue I'll kind of hint at something at the first of the issue, which will be resolved by the end of the issue, which in some way will be some sort of twist or hook to get, you know, people, the readers, to sort of buy the following issue. It's kind of, you know, just like a TV show. Tune in next week to see how so-and-so gets out of this mess. But I'm excited to hear that you all thought that end was surprising.
Very much so.
As soon as I got to that last page, I was like, oh no, now I have to wait like 5 more weeks for the next one.
I do know a guy that's got the PDF of the next issue, so you never know. Might not.
Now, Sarah, that's really teasing. Of course you can, Bob. Go.
Yeah. What I love so much about it, as you say, it's led by motivations and it's about those characters. I'm a big fan of that period as well. I mean, when I was a kid, Bonnie and Clyde had come out, and a movie I'll mention in passing, Roger Corman's St. Valentine's Day Massacre from 1967, which is actually the script was written by a fellow who was a crime reporter in Chicago at that point. And so the dialogue in Tommy Gun Wizards so crackles with that period. Oh, and it's just crazy. It's just little idioms, right? It's just calling someone a palooka. It's those things. It makes everything sing. How much research did you do and just watch old movies, or how did you find those little gems?
Old movies, and just like noting down words that I liked, and also just that I found a really good website that was basically about the language and slang of the 1930s, which I just pulled over. And see, I would have like, okay, so I've got these 5 slang words for this meaning, and then it was like, well, which of my characters would use that word?
Which one? Yeah.
You know, who does that feel like? Well, he's not going to say it because he's this sort of person, and she's not going to say it because she's this sort of person, but she might say this. And so it's about kind of feeling of those slang words, which is right for which person. I'm really pleased that you thought it sounded authentic, because I was aware, you know, as a Brit writing, you know, about 1930 Chicago, I was a little bit worried that people would be like, who's this guy writing about? You know, I mean, which is what, it's quite funny, because so I open with, you know, this is not our America. I kind of almost wanted to sort of excuse myself of any, you know, mistakes that we would likely make. So it's nice to hear that for yourself it worked.
Absolutely so.
Christian, are we able to talk a little bit about some of the magic that we find in the first issue, or is that off limits?
No, you should. You can ask anything you like. I may not answer certain things, but I would say most things in the first issue, apart from the last little bit, is fine.
Okay, so for the some of the magic portions of Tommy Gun Wizards, we see that people are using the stuff called the Lick, which basically allows them to grants them certain magical abilities, if you will. I won't go into it too much. My question is that if the Lick can be used for like almost everyday things or to complete sometimes menial tasks, if you were to have your own stash of the Lick, of that little bit of magic, what do you think would be a task, like an everyday thing or maybe a professional thing
that you could shortcut through magic.
Hang on, sorry. I don't know if you can hear that in the background. My dog's just going ballistic.
That's okay. Can you say
it? Yeah. Hang on, let me just go and...
I would love to know how many dogs we've had on this podcast.
I think many. I also love the fact that the dog is called Thor. He's an adorable awesome little pug, and there's always pictures of him on social media, and I love him to pieces. He's so cute.
Aww. We've had kids, we've had dogs, my cat.
I've got somebody's just bought a TV round, and so the dog's barking and the baby's crying, and it's all gone chaos. But I'm gonna pretend I haven't heard any of that, and we'll continue.
I'll edit that out. Don't worry.
Christian, if you need to take a break to go and take care of some business, that's no problem.
No, I think we're all right. I think we're okay. I think it's all calming down now. No, it's all fine. It's all calming down. Do you want to repeat the question?
Sure. Okay. So in Tommy Gunn Wizards, kind of some of the magic that is going around comes in the form of the lick, which is, I would imagine, an elixir that you can choose to use it how you will, but a lot of people use it for small tasks and favors, kind of like getting your hair right, or perhaps you want more muscle mass, stuff like that.
Yeah.
If you had your own stash of the lick, what is like an everyday task or maybe even a professional shortcut that you can think of that you would use it for?
Oh, just draw faster. That's it. It's that mundane. I just draw faster. And like my attention span is terrible. So when I'm drawing a comic, and I know I've spoken to like a lot of other peers, and they don't do this. So I'll draw, like if I'm drawing an issue of Invisible Kingdom, for instance, I'll start it, and I have to have about 10 pages on the go at any one time. So what I'll do is I'll draw a little bit of one, find myself getting distracted and the attention waning, and then I'll jump over to another page and start that and continue on that one, which will then refresh my attention and keep me focused on it. And then when it wanes on that one, I jump to another page. So it's always really frustrating, I imagine, for like, you know, like Camberg and my editors, because I don't like, there's no finished pages until like really close to the end of the deadline, because they're just, I'm not doing them bit by bit. I'm working on them all in one go. So it'd be nice to have, to use the lick just to draw really well, really fast. And all my problems would be solved.
Fantastic.
I don't know if you folks could hear it, but my neighbor's dog across the street is barking. He's a Roddy pug mix of some kind, and his name is Loki. So
no.
I think, yes, no lie, I just think it's perfect.
Oh my god! Don't tell Phil that; he'll hear you.
It's all coming together.
Yeah. Yes.
I have a question about the actual craft of art, just while we're on that and you talking about sort of drawing multiple pages at once. Do you draw digitally or traditionally, or is it a combination of both? Because I suppose I've just got this kind of mental picture of you just surrounded by desks with all different pages on them.
I'm digital. There is a traditional element, which is watercolour. But that's a textural point of view. So so what I'll do is I'll draw the book digitally. And this is all my comics are done in the same way. And then I will use watercolour texture that I've painted and scanned, almost like a jigsaw, and laying it over the top of the digital colours to kind of create that aesthetic that I really like, which is that combination of digital and watercolour. Just so it's really hard to kind of work out how I've done the work. I really like the fact that a lot of people sort of look at my work and go, oh, that's watercolour, when it's not. but yeah, so it's a combination of the two. But I couldn't do what I do traditionally, I don't think. I need the ability just to be able to go, that's a mistake, do that one again. That's something you can really do in digital really easily.
That makes a lot more sense now. I'm looking at... the Zatanna print that I got from you a year or so ago, and now I can understand a lot more how you actually managed to do that.
Well, it's weird actually because that I mean, the colouring in that one is digital, but that's actually a hand-drawn picture, and that was one of my last things that I did traditionally.
Wow.
Interestingly enough.
I adore that piece. I'm just gazing at her now adoringly.
she was always a favourite.
So, just to rein it back in before I wander off in my mind. Going back to Tommy Gunn Wizards, there is a backup story in issue one, which presumably is relating to the main storyline, but we kind of don't really get a feel for that in the first issue. How many issues is it going to take for us to find out how that backup story relates to the main storyline, or am I jumping too far ahead?
So basically, I really wanted that to be quite... I want the main story to be really clear and for the readers to really follow what's happening. I don't want it to be difficult. I want it to be really kind of straightforward. But the backup, I wanted it to feel quite obtuse and strange and confusing. I actually kind of... I was okay with it feeling confusing.
Okay.
But it will. You'll start to see connections as early as the next issue, and there were only three backup stories. Because it's we're starting this arc that we've done is only four issues,
right.
And so we've got a backup story in one, two, and I'm literally looking at the third one, and I'm working on that one now. And then the last issue of this arc is all Sammy, because we end on a real oversized issue and there wasn't enough space to have a backup. So there'll be it'll make, when you've read the third one, it will kind of, that's where there'll be a sense of how those connect. I mean, ideally, this book's going to sell well enough that... We can return to this world because there's an awful lot of story to sort of, you know, explore. But what's quite nice is we are going to, it'll wrap up a story, and it'll feel very, hopefully very kind of satisfying for people that pick it up. But obviously we do want to leave a few threads loose and unexplained so that we, you know, so that if we do return, we can kind of explore those and you know, take the book to some interesting places. I mean, it makes sense to me, the backups, but obviously I kind of know where it's going. But
yeah.
I've been giving it to some friends, some of the writers, and they all assure me that it really works on a really interesting level, and kind of gives, as we proceed, it'll give a different texture to what's going on and might make you rethink what's going on. Reading carefully what I'm saying.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm even more intrigued now. I mean, I was going to say, is it designed to be a limited series, or do you have other tales to tell in the world? But obviously,
there's a lot more. I mean, when I originally pitched it to Dark Horse, it was pitched as a 12 issue series.
Yeah.
With the view of there being another 12 issue series, but the cold hard truth of it is, you know, I may have been working for the last 10 years as an artist, but as far as a writer goes, and you know, essentially this is my debut book. You know, I'm starting from scratch. I'm nobody, and so it was a bit of a big ask, and I realise that now. Kind of asking for, hey, give me my 24 stories to tell this epic story that, you know, it's going to be really good. They don't know it's going to be really good, you know, nobody knows that, maybe not even me. So it was kind of agreed that we would do a four issue story that made sense and had a beginning, middle and end based on this 12 issue. So I took, it's weird, it was almost like, you know, when you see like a movie and it takes a, you know, 12 issue comic and it turns it into a 2-hour movie. And the ones that really work really cherry pick what's really crucial and what really makes sense. It was kind of like that. It was almost like I was the comic that we've made is almost an adaptation of the comic that's been in my head. But it was a really interesting process of boiling it down and removing the fat and just think, okay, just let's keep it fun, keep the pace up, and just make it a really good read, and just, you know, make it a ride. But I really hope we're going to get another arc, because the next arc, if we get to do it, is better, because I'll be able to, you know, like any good, you know, if you look at, like, you know, something like kind of Breaking Bad or any other kind of good kind of ongoing TV shows, the more you do, the more you can kind of take characters to interesting places. And that's what I want to do. You know, I really want to just do really kind of interesting things and introduce characters. And there's a real life person called Carrie Nation. I don't know if any of you know who Carrie Nation is.
Oh, yeah.
And for anyone who doesn't know, Carrie Nation was this, she was just like this badass woman that really didn't like alcohol. So she would, even pre-prohibition, she would go into bars and any kind of establishment selling alcohol with an axe and just smash the hell out of them. And just attack people. And she was like a real badass. And so so if we do an arc two, she's going to be our big antagonist for the second arc, because I've got a really interesting idea how would that character work if it wasn't alcohol and it was magic. I think it'd be really cool. Hopefully people will buy it. Hopefully people will love it. And then, you know, word of mouth will keep the book alive, and fingers crossed we Sammy's all up for carrying it on. He knows where the story's going, he's excited for it. So it's a case of just if it does well, then we'll get another arc. I mean, I think it will be, we'll kind of release it, fingers crossed, a little bit like other Dark Horse books, you know, in the Mignola universe, that it won't be like an ongoing, we'll come back and do another four or five issues, and then we'll go away again, and then we'll come back and do another four or five issues. And eventually I can almost see, because there is a lot of story, and without spoiling anything, some of it happens in one place and some of it might happen in another place. It'd be lovely to almost get other artists involved and tell different bits of the story in different parts of the world, so that this it's kind of creating something that kind of all kind of fits together. It's really hard to talk about it.
It's very mysterious.
I'm even more intrigued now. And I had already pre-ordered my copy from my local comic shop, because they know that I fangirl over your artwork anyway. You've definitely sold a copy to me for what that's worth. Nice. Talking about some other things that you've worked on, I would very much like to talk about Invisible Kingdom quickly, if we may, which is another book that I have really been enjoying. Where did the opportunity to work with G. Willow Wilson on Invisible Kingdom come from? Was it sort of how did that come about?
Oh, that was all Karen Berger. She dropped me a line on Twitter, weirdly of all places, and just said, you know, she just set up the Berger book imprint to Dark Horse, and asked me if I'd be interested in doing a book. You know, Willow was going to come back to create her own after finishing off Miss Marvel, and would I be interested in doing it? And initially, I think I said no initially. I know. It's nothing that they both don't know. I wasn't on board straight away, and that's nothing to do with Willow or Karen, who are both legends. It was all to do with my worry about being typecasted. So I'd come off, you know, I'd done Infinite Vacation, which is kind of like sci-fi tinged. Then I did Odyssey, which is kind of like cosmic psychedelic sci-fi. And then I did Black Bolt, which was, for all intents and purposes, another kind of gothic sci-fi. And then Marvel had asked me to do some issues for Thor, and I was like, great. Oh, it's the Thor set in distant future sci-fi again. So I've done it again. It's like Thor flying around in cosmic space. I was like, God, it's all like, and I was really really worried about, is this all I'm ever going to be able to do? And what happens when sci-fi is not popular anymore? Does that mean I'm not popular anymore? And, you know, it was a real concern. And then Karen said, we've got this great idea. And I was like, wow. And then they told it me. And I was like, oh, no, not another sci-fi. I was like, oh, God. And it's also about, can I do something that is not like what I did with Odyssey? Can I do something that's not like what I did with Black Bolt? You know, or am I just going to be, you know, repeating myself? So me and Willow had a big long chat on Skype, and I told her my concerns, and I said, you know, I think the idea is brilliant, and I get the idea, but I just don't know if I want to do another sci-fi. But over the course of, like, I think we spoke for an hour and a half, 2 hours, she just, the more she told me about the world and the story, the more it's just like, oh, it was so cool. And one thing I really love, my favorite thing about Willow's work is the characters. I don't think there's anyone working today that has such a strong sense of, like, an ensemble of characters. You know, she's able to create, like, a group of people that all feel real and disparate from each other and relate to each other in really interesting, real, humane and funny ways. And her scripts just made me laugh, which I've not had with any other writer I've worked with, even if there's had, like, moments of comedy. Hers are genuinely funny, you know, when a character says something or quips something. And that was something I hadn't done a lot of in my work. Like, there wasn't a lot of comedy. I really loved drawing comedy. And so it was about thinking, okay, well, the challenge in is not necessarily about making this sci-fi book look different. That's not my hook and the challenge that's going to get me into this. It's how I'm going to make the characters real and feel like people, and how I'm going to sell the comedy. So once I kind of got my head around that, I was on board, and oh, thank God I was. You know, I think I would have made a really, really stupid mistake if I'd said no. Luckily I came to my senses quick.
Sarah, can I just jump in quickly?
Yeah, of course you can.
Yeah, because it's on this topic. Your art is amazingly cosmic, but it's also so grounded in being humanistic, and that's through the subtleties of body language and expression. It sells that comedy.
How
do you balance that? How do you achieve that?
I don't know. I think it's just, I think really it just comes from my love of storytelling and you know, it all comes down to characters, and it all comes down to people feeling real. You know, that's, you know, when you're reading a story, it can be as, and, you know, this is immensely true with Tommy Gunn, it can be as far-fetched as anything, but if it doesn't feel real, not to say look real, but feel real, then your reader cannot connect with that. So even, you know, in the Invisible Kingdom, even though we've got, you know, people with green skin and some people that have got far more kind of alien-like features, they have to respond in human ways that we recognize, so that, you know, fiction's a mirror for us. We, you know, we laugh at what we find funny, what reminds us of things. And so it's always really important to sort of, that's the starting point, and the cosmic stuff is just what I fill in around the edges. The characters and the story is always the root of it, not the spectacle. The spectacle comes after. That makes sense.
No, absolutely. I'm just looking at a panel here where Grix is. She has this little smirk on her face when it's talking about canceled orders, and it's that sort of resignation that, oh, geez.
Yeah.
Another one of these, huh?
Yeah.
Perfect.
So I don't know, like, kind of, have you seen that photograph of, from, like, really old school Walt Disney animators, and they've got, like, kind of mirrors on their desk?
Yes, yes.
And they're kind of gurning at themselves. It's similar to that. You're kind of, I'll read the scripts, and you have to act it. You have to really connect. I'll read a script from Willow or any script that I'm working on two or three times before I start, because it's about rereading the what the characters are saying, but also what they're not saying.
Yes.
And how they're, you know, how they're reacting to each other, and having a sense of who is Grix, and what does she want, and why is this annoying her, how's that all going to play? And then she makes this very naive, preppy kind of Vess, and how is she going to react to her, and how's Vess going to react? And then you've got, you know, all these other characters, and how, you know, and it's all about knowing how are they going to kind of respond to this situation in a kind of real way. But also, the same way with cinema, you know, you don't have to, when you're an actor on stage in a play, you have your performance has to be larger than life so that people sitting in the back can see it. When you're on a cinema screen, it can be really subtle because it's blown up. And I think in the same regard, when you're working on a comic, I don't have to change many lines to kind of convey the acting and the emotion of what a character's going through. It can be really subtle. It can just be like one line, literally one line on the brow can just completely transform what's going on with a character's in a monologue that's kind of being conveyed by their face. And it's something that, you know, I will draw a page out and I'll redraw a character's face two, three, sometimes four times before I'm really like, you know, I'm happy with that. That feels right. And I'll sometimes, I might like kind of take a photograph of myself and just be like, you know, pulling faces and actually just, well, actually I was saying pulling faces, but I don't. What I tend to do is I tend to sort of like think about what the character's thinking about and then take a photograph of myself as I'm thinking about what the character's thinking about and then use that. So it's a weird like kind of, I try to sort of like be as naturalistic as I can and think, okay, what's happening? But it's all, you know, it almost goes back to what you sort of was said at the start. Why did I want to kind of write instead of draw? For me, and I know I'm not alone in this, a lot of our writers are the same. It's all so interconnected. Even though Willow's writing the script, I'm still so engaged with the story because I have to be, in order to know where I'm putting the camera, know where, what moment needs the big space, what moment needs the kind of quiet bit, who I need to focus on in the scene, who I need to sort of show and what their reactions is. And so I have to be like really, really intimate with Willow's story in order that I can do her story justice. And so it's kind of, you learn from that over years that you mean you can just put it into your own stuff quite easily.
You do that. Hey, by the way, when is the trade coming out? That should be fairly soon, right? I think I saw the you people twittering out. I don't do that twittery thing.
It's October sometime. Because the trades get printed, they send them off somewhere to get printed, and it takes a little bit longer than it does the floppies just to keep the printing cost down. So it takes about 3 months to print. But I believe it's, I don't think it's in time for NYC, so it's not early October. I think it's like the middle of October, I want to say. But it's October sometime. Yeah.
Great.
Yeah, and then we come back.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's around the time as well that you come back for...
That's right. I think the issue 6 is out the last week of October, and I think the trade is either the week before that or the week 2 weeks before that.
Awesome. Yeah. I, for one, am very excited for the return of Invisible Kingdom.
It gets better.
That's quite a claim.
Yeah. Yes. I think Willow's, this arc is, it's really cool. Like the stuff that she's getting me to draw there's a new character, and I won't say too much. Sexy pirate comes in, and he is so cool. Like, he's so much fun to draw, and he just like throws the cats amongst the pigeons. And a lot of it is set, and I don't want to spoil her story, but it's set in a slightly different place. So it's cool. It really, she's really saying something with this arc. No, well, not that she didn't say anything with the first arc, but she's like saying something like alongside the whole theme, specifically with this arc that I really like. I really resonated with me. And some really cool, quite inventive sequences that she's come up with that have been a lot of fun to draw. So yeah, I think these two, like I'm working on issue 7 now. I think issue 6 and 7 are some of my best work. I think that's been inspired by Willow writing some of her best scripts. So I think, yeah, it's only going to get better.
Christian, can you tell us, is the plan for you to remain the artist on the series throughout, or are there plans to introduce other people?
If they were to introduce another person to Invisible Kingdom, that person would not last very long. I would be sure. No. It's me and Willow. So it's our book that we created.
Awesome.
I mean, there's only going to be 3 arcs, as far as I know. So the plan was for 15 issues. Whether that will change once we kind of get to the kind of getting close to the end, there has been some talk, I think, of making it an ongoing and then just keep going with it. But I suppose that's not really a decision that will be up to me or Willow, really. I think it'll be more a case of whether the public wants it. But I know there's going to be at least 15 issues.
Awesome. I'm so glad to hear that it's the two of you remaining on that book. I love that series so much. Yeah. I would have been devastated.
Well, you're not going away from this call devastated, I can promise you that. Only not devastated yet. By how amazing it's going to be.
There you go. Indeed.
You say, I was just going to say, I just wanted to briefly touch on Black Bolt as well, because obviously you've talked about your art style and you didn't want to get kind of pigeonholed into having this psychedelic crazy art style. But obviously Black Bolt was visually a long way from the usual like Marvel house style. Was that a deliberate move because it was Saladin's first comic that he was working on and Marvel wanted to do something completely different? Or did you face any pressure from sort of editorial to keep it within more of a certain style? Or can you not say?
No. I mean, I was hired by a guy called Will Moss, if you look at what Will does at Marvel, like so many of his books are like the big books. Like he does Immortal Hulk, and he did Hawkeye with Matt. He did Black Bolt with me and Saladin. He did just the Thor books. A lot of the books that he does, or he did Vision as well with Tom King. They're all. Then none of them are really the main, within the main Marvel universe. They're all on the outskirts. And I think kind of the reason why he gets away with getting artists that aren't typical on them is because he's just got a great eye for putting a team and a story together. And, so many, if you look at all the Marvel books that have won Eisners over the years, they're all his babies. Hulk and Hawkeye and I think kind of because of that he's probably given a bit more free rein to sort of like go a bit crazy. But yeah, there was never any communication to sort of for me to soften my style or do something more conventional. But I think a lot of that freedom comes from the fact it wasn't an A-list character. Black Bolt is kind of like a fan favorite, and if you look at some of the artists that have done the Inhumans over the last 10-15 years, they're all quite kind of European in flavor, they're all slightly off kilter. So I think it kind of, me doing it felt in keeping with that history. So it was great. And I think I wrote a little thing when we did issue 12, that it felt far more like a creator-owned comic than a Marvel comic, or Big Two comic. It was an interesting time because my daughter was born. Like, it was the biggest book I'd ever done at the time,
and had the biggest spotlight on it. And they offered it me while I was in the process of, you know, we started working on it while I was in the process of moving house, leaving London. I had to move in with my parents for like 2 months with my wife while we waited for the new house for the sale to complete. And then we moved into the new house, and then we had to do all these renovations, and then we had our live, and it was crazy. So it was like the most important book of my career at that time. Never worked for Marvel on a long form. It was happening at the same time that the most important, you know, time in my personal life was happening, my family life. So it was crazy, and some of those issues were done in like 4 weeks on very little sleep because of, you know, just having a newborn baby in the house. And there was so much. I didn't even send them roughs. It was just like, there's a script, and I was like, okay, there's the, and it was that I was sending it to them going, oh my god, well, they're going to be stuck because they're going to have to use it because then they won't have time to change it. But it,
that could
it
be a good plan out. Moving forward.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's a good job I'm professional, because I could have really screwed it over. I was just like, yeah, stick that in there. I fancy joining Mr. Fantastic. I'll put him in. Never mind. I'll put him in. And yeah, it worked out really well. And I think kind of because me and Saladin just hit off, and we just really, really liked each other. And I loved what he was doing with the story, and it was it was just so much fun. And obviously it worked out really well. It does really well for them now. They're doing the hardcover, which comes out, I believe, either late this year or early next. And you know, we got the eyes and everything, so we must have done something right. So the moral of the story is I need to work on less sleep, not more of it. Yeah.
That's maybe not the best idea. So when you worked with Saladin on Black Bolt, that, I think I'm right in saying this, was his first comic that he'd ever written. Yeah. He was well known for his long form fiction and his poetry. How was it working with a writer on their first ever book?
It was fine. Yeah, it was good. I mean, it was great. Like he was very, very matter of fact. He said, look, I'm going to make mistakes on this, and just please tell me when I do. And obviously I was a little bit worried because I was coming off working with Matt, and so I was like, oh, this could be, you know, I might have made a mistake here, but there was no need to worry because he was brilliant. You'd never know it was his first comic. He just took to the, you know, the format like a duck to water. He had no issues at all. There was nothing. There was no worries. Had no kind of like problems with his script, or he just got it. He got it immediately.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Did that sort of have any influence on the way that you then worked with Sammy on Tommy Gunn Wizards? Did that kind of influence the way that you wrote the script? Or,
well, I think it's, I suppose it's like, it's like I've drawn a lot of I've drawn a lot of comparisons with what I do with cinema, and I'm going to draw another one now, which I think is quite apt. And that's the, you know, you'll often get kind of like actors who then become directors themselves. And you often hear that those directors are really good directors in regards to actors, and it just follows through because they know what they like and what makes what gets a good performance out of an actor. And it's the same thing. Like, I've been very fortunate that I've worked with collaborators who have allowed me the freedom to kind of do what I want to do within within the context of the story. You know, if I've by and large, you follow the script as written, but every now and again, you might think, oh, that would work really well with an extra panel, or maybe with a panel removed, or that would work really well if actually I made that a splash and then had characters moving around the splash or whatever. And I knew that, knowing Sammy's work, he kind of comes at the page in a similar way that I do. He'll deconstruct a page and do really interesting things with it. And I thought, I'm going to cripple him if I don't allow him the same privileges that I had. And he's a very different artist to me, and his work looks very different to mine. But if I, and so when I'm picturing pages, I'll often see them how I would draw them. And I just had to sort of like separate myself from that. I thought, well, he's not going to draw it like I would. And if I wanted it to look like how it would look like if I drew it, well, then I should have just drawn it. And so it was a case of just trusting him. Like, he's an excellent artist. And I really hope he becomes a really big star because he really deserves it. And so I let him do his thing, you know. I knew he got the story. I knew he got the characters. And that was the main thing. As long as he was on the same page and he wasn't like trying to subvert it and turn it into a story it wasn't, then we were fine. And because I knew he didn't want it, he wanted the same thing for it that I did, it was a case of just letting him go. I mean, every now and again, I might be like, well, try that. Go from left, just flip the panel, go from left to right, or try that here. But I think the notes I gave him were, you know, he might have like, on an issue of 24 pages, I might give him notes on maybe 2 or 3 pages, and they'd be very minor. Because it'd just be a case of letting him do his thing. So it's fun for him. And I think that's the thing. If he's having fun drawing it, and I'm giving him stuff that's exciting for him to draw and is, you know, a blast, then that's going to come through. His enjoyment's going to then filter through, hopefully, to the reader. Because they'll then enjoy what he's drawing. So it's just about kind of having, you know, comics are a collaborative process, and you can't do that unless you trust your collaborators. And the pleasure is that they're going to come back with something that's going to surprise you. So you get to enjoy your own story in a way that you didn't think you could.
That's a really awesome way of looking at it. So, obviously, Tommy Gunn Wizards, the first issue comes out on the 28th of August. What is next for you in the world of comics after Tommy Gunn Wizards? I know you said you're working on Invisible Kingdom at the moment. What else is on the slate, if you're allowed to tell us?
I don't know. It's tricky. I mean, I've got a year left of Invisible Kingdom. I've got a year left of drawing. Now, so there's a few things happening that are kind of bubbling away on kind of beneath the surface. I have to make a decision of what I want to draw next, and it's whether I want to do something that I write and draw, or whether I want to work with another writer on a story that might appeal to me, and what that might be. Whether I want to go back to Marvel and do something there, whether I want to go to DC and do something there. I mean, I think at the moment, DC are doing some really interesting stuff on the Black Label, and that appeals to me. I'd love to do that. I don't know, like a Swamp Thing or something like that over there. I know. In the same token, I've got some ideas for some stories that I want to sort of do, and both write and draw. So it may be that I go from Invisible Kingdom to another creative realm, but I'm the writer. And I suppose that will depend on how well Tommy Gunn does. And if that does really well, then that gives me a momentum to kind of carry on. I've got two other projects that I'm kind of prepping very slowly in the background. Once I'll finish work on Tommy Gunn next month, and that'll be done. And then I can start working on these other two projects, both of which are horrors, both of which are with other artists. One of which has already got a semi green light of Dark Horse. We'll have to put a pitch together, and then that goes up to the kind of the higher ups at Dark Horse to get a yay or a nay. Which would be a completely different thing to anything I've done before. Which would be interesting. I really like horror, so I'm kind of intrigued to sort of do something a bit nihilistic and a bit quieter. It'll be very different to Tommy Gunn. We'll see how that goes. And then ideally I want to do 2 or 3 projects a year that I'm writing with other artists drawing, and that will hopefully keep going. And I'll do that at Dark Horse, or, you know, maybe Image or somewhere else. And then just see what happens. I'll make a decision what I'm doing probably next year, because, as I say, I'll be working until late August on Invisible Kingdom, so I don't really need to start thinking about what I'm doing next until maybe sort of like March, April time. But things are brewing up. We'll see where Tommy Gunn takes me. I know I've sent it to some editors at Marvel and DC, and people seem to be quite impressed with it. So, you know, if they come back and say, we'd love you to write and draw X, Y, Z, that might be something I'd consider. I know.
lots of irons in the fire, then. That's really, really good to hear.
Yeah. We'll see how it goes. I mean, it's funny, the comic industry. You just have to, it's like ladders. You can't make a step until you finish the step before, and it's all like, you know, it's a waiting process to see how this book does. I mean, the early reviews have been really, really positive. My peers have been very positive about it. It's just whether it catches with the public and whether people really dig it. I hope they do. I think it's good. So fingers crossed.
Awesome. Well, I for one very much enjoyed reading it. I'm looking forward to actually getting a copy in my hands. And cool. Anyone who listens to the show that has bought books on my recommendation before, because I know there are people out there that have, because they've then come back to me and gone, oh, I really like this book you said was good. Go read Tommy Gunn Wizards.
Yeah.
Steve, I know that you had a couple of questions. So do you want to jump in?
Sure. Yeah, I've got a couple of random ones for you.
Yep.
Christian, do you work while listening to music?
Sometimes it tends to be more podcasts than music, or I quite like having like a film on in the background, because a film's like a 2-hour film. It was really good, but like I'll have that in the background and then I'll do a page. But are you going to ask me what music I listen to? Is that where this is going? And I'm dragging you away from where you want it to go.
wherever you want to take the question, man, it's up to you.
Well music, I mean, it can't be anything with lyrics, weirdly. That's weird.
Okay.
Probably the thing that I draw to more than anything is a kind of British kind of electronic techno band called Orbital. Orbital.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
So Orbital's a real old favorite. I love Orbital, and they're really good to draw to, because it's kind of like very melodic and very kind of dramatic and very, like, you know, yeah. So you almost, it's almost like a film soundtrack. You can and your brain almost does this thing where you're like, oh, this is the soundtrack to what I'm drawing, and then that kind of ramps up your enjoyment with what you're drawing, and they're like, I would say they're my go-to, and it's kind of like bands around them, like kind of Boards of Canada or Plaid, the go-tos for kind of like working while I'm listening. So like electronica, kind of that sort of thing, broken beat sort of stuff.
Yeah. Fun fact for people listening to the show, everybody knows how much I love the band Tool and cannot shut up about them since their new album comes out on August 30th. Orbital actually played, they were the headlining band of the year I went to Lollapalooza. I had attended two of those shows in the past, and it was Tool and Orbital were the closers. And man, they tore it up.
Oh, they're amazing live. They are so good live.
Big time.
Yeah.
All right. Let's see. What else do I got here? You said that you like films quite a bit. Can you tell us the names of three films from your childhood that might have had a lasting impact on your art?
I mentioned, Batman at the start of this. I mean, I think that's got a big, had a big lasting impression on me. I mean, I saw that when I was 12 years old, and it was such a kind of iconic visual thing that it was when I first started being aware of, like, you know, visuals of things. If I go back further, Disney's Black Hole is one, and Tron is another. Both Disney films, and both kind of things that were quite dark and quite kind of psychedelic and lots of neon colors. Those two particularly.
I can particularly see like the light cycle streaks.
Yes.
Being an influence in some of your artwork, especially for Invisible Kingdom.
Definitely. Yeah. And when I was a kind of teenager, things like Akira, I remember watching that on like VHS when it first came out.
Yeah. A good one.
Yeah. And that really had that did a lot. And like Flash Gordon, like the from the 80s, again, that kind of resonated quite strongly.
How did you feel? Have you ever seen the Akira that was released with a new dub?
It just felt weird. It just felt wrong.
It's weird. Do yourself a favor. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, it's weird because obviously now whenever I watch kind of anime, I mean, not that I can watch it that much because it's not a good thing to watch while I'm working, because of wanting to watch it in the original language with subtitles. But like Akira is one of the few animes that I can't watch the Japanese language, because it's obviously when I watched it as a child on VHS, it was the dub, and so those voices and those characters, those actors playing those roles are so intrinsically Akira to me now that nothing else seems right. Very good.
I think that's all I've got. Bob, do you have any other questions for Christian?
Well, I know we're talking about movies and things here. I don't know that it's ever come out over in the UK, but did you ever see the old 50s Untouchables television show?
No, actually, I didn't know that was a thing.
Yeah, because Elliot Ness wrote a book called The Untouchables somewhere in the middle 50s. And then Desilu did a series at very staccato rhythms. Hello, little one.
Can you hear me?
Oh, it's good. I love it.
Stumbled in like the have you seen that thing with the guy on BBC News when his kids kind of stumble in?
Yeah.
It's basically the same thing. She's come in and now she's playing on my floor with. She's found some polystyrene. She's breaking it up. She's shaking her head. She's smiling. You okay? Awesome. She says, "Yeah, I'm okay."
But I'm sure somewhere on YouTube they might even have just the opening. But they had the old radio announcer, newspaper fellow Walter Winchell reading these really sort of grim, punchy openings, and it was pretty violent for 50s television. And they did the Capone story and going to Alcatraz and all that sort of stuff. If you get a chance, just check out some what that looks like.
No,
it
might
be some fun for you.
Oh, cool. Thank you. I'll look that up.
Sarah, why don't we let Christian
play with his daughter?
Yeah, I think Olive's slightly more important than us at this point. So thank you very, very much for taking the time to speak to us today, Christian. And obviously, as we said, you know, Tommy Gun Wizards comes out on Wednesday, the 28th of August. Please go and pick it up. So thanks again for talking to us.
Oh, you're more than welcome.
Hey, everybody. We are back. Thank you so, so much to Christian for coming and hanging out with us. Fantastic interview, Sarah. Thank you so much for putting that together.
Thank you very much. I'm just pleased that he could come and talk to us. He's a really, really cool guy.
I've been quite the booking agent lately for the old Talking Comics and Ladies of Valhalla.
I try. The guest that I majorly teased last week for Ladies of Valhalla looks like it is going to happen. So I'm already getting excited about our October episode. But obviously, you know, the lovely Mr. Whitley will be joining us next month. Ooh. So I'm just going to hang out over here at the cool kids table.
Gail Simone is going to be at Fan Expo Canada this coming weekend. So I hope to stop by. Yeah, there's... One of the reasons I'm very excited to go this year is that there are a lot of creators that I've never met and that I love. And I mean, I've gone to enough cons that I've met the vast majority of people that I read and stuff like that.
Mm.
But like Donnie Cates is going to be there. Mirka Andolfo is going to be there. I've only met up with Gail that one time when Bob and I spoke with her at the con. So it'll be nice to see her again. And just a whole bunch of other creators. They really went above and beyond this year to get some really cool people at that show. I'm looking forward to it.
So, nice.
Meow. Let's talk about books that we're looking forward to next week. Bob, what are you picking up?
Oh, we got Betty Page Unbound number 3. Is this still the Crisis on Infinite Bettys? We've got Jimmy Olsen number 2. We've got Fearless number 2, Valkyrie number 2. It's a big week along those fronts. Aquaman 51. Also have, coming from IDW, the all-ages Marvel action, Captain Marvel number 1.
Very nice. Sarah, how about you?
Okay, so Aquaman 51, Avant-Garde 7 of 12, Fearless 2 of 3, Middle West number 10, American Gods Moment of Storm number 5, and then we get into the number ones. Marvel Action Captain Marvel number 1, that looks adorable. It's all about Flerkin taking over bodegas in Manhattan. Really excited about that. There is a book called Headless, number one, the front cover of which has got so many Paper Girls vibes coming off it. It's unbelievable. Ooh. It's about some brothers who move to Salem, Massachusetts, and discover that a headless phantom is going around being a serial killer. So they decide to look into it. Bad Reception, number one, is about a big celebrity wedding in the middle of nowhere where there's no internet and you're not allowed to use any tech. And then someone starts killing the wedding guests and marking them with hashtags. And I'm like, social commentary. Don't mind if I do. That's actually written and drawn by Juan Doe, who did the art for Dark Ark. So I'm excited about that.
Ooh.
And then there's a book coming out called Pretty Violent, number one. And the front cover actually says Pretty Violent and lots of swears. And it is by one half of the creative team for I Hate Fairyland. And it's about a girl who is born with superpowers into a family of superpowered people. She wants to be a hero. All of her siblings are supervillains. How does she go against the family business and become a hero? It looks absolutely hilarious. It's got a very I Hate Fairyland, Bully Wars kind of vibe to it, based on the front cover. So, yeah, again, who needs food? I've got books.
I'm going to need the names of... I have Pretty Violent on my list, but what was the other one? Headless?
Headless, number one, which is from Scout Comics, I believe.
Oh, that might be difficult to get. I'll have to go to the store for that one, I guess.
Mm.
And what was the other one? The one Bad Reception?
Bad Reception, yes.
Oh, what a great play.
Which is
an
awesome title. As soon as I saw that, I was like, oh, the pun in the title. I'm going to have to read this. And then,
what's the publisher on that?
Aftershock.
Okay.
That was as much of a question as a comment. You could tell. Bad Reception comic combines murder and smartphone addiction. Aftershock, yeah.
All right, awesome. That sounds great. I'll have to check that out. My list, I also have Avant-Garde's number 7, Aquaman 51, Batman number 77, Middle West number 10, Pretty Violent, and Headless, if I could find it. Bad Reception, number 1, sounds great. Weatherman, volume 2, number 3. Powers of X, number 3. And Valkyrie, Jane Foster, number 2. All right.
Big week all around.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so weird. We're recording on a Sunday. I'm so used to waking up the next day. I'm like, oh, man, I can't wait to read that book Sarah's talking about in
Wednesday.
4 or 5 days. Yeah.
Sorry.
That's all right. That's how we got to do it for a little while until Jess decides to bring it on back. All right. Let's see. Does anybody have any final statements, comments, questions, anything? Closing statements?
Nope.
Nothing.
Not from me.
Wow.
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 And every week he's got to make an appearance. All right. I guess that's going to do it. Yeah. We'll be at Fan Expo this weekend again. If you want to say hi, just reach out to us on Twitter. We'll try to meet up with you Friday, Saturday. I will be there on Saturday. Brahman will be there both Friday and Saturday. We've reached the end of this week's edition of the Talking Comics podcast. Thanks again to Christian for coming and hanging out with us. As always, you can send us your comments or questions through our email, podcast@talkingcomicbooks.com. We are also on Twitter @TalkingComics. Don't forget to check out TalkingComicBooks.com for reviews from our fantastic contributors. And please go listen to Talking Valiant, D&D Adventure, and the Ladies of Valhalla podcasts. Bob, where can our listeners find you?
Old-fashioned email, BobRyer@TalkingComicBooks.com.
Sarah?
You can find me everywhere media is social. I am @GeekCountryLady.
Huzzah. I am @Dead_Anchoress on Twitter and Instagram. Joey is @JoeyBricino. And Jessica is at Jarsica on all the things. So for Bob.
Feel better, Sarah.
For Sarah.
See you all soon.
And for me, thank you so much for listening. Be excellent to each other. And until next time on the Talking Comics Podcast, to be continued. Greetings and salutations. It's August 21st, 2019, otherwise known as... Ugh.
How many times have you done this?
I stepped on a pillow that has a massager inside of it, and it freaked me out, and it knocked me off my groove. Here we go.